understand the reality of it. If you push people around, and genocide is certainly pushing people around, and continue to do so as a way of life and predicate your so-called quality of life upon a perpetration of that genocide on a perpetual basis, eventually somebody is going to have to push back. And they did.
That is the by now familiar voice of Ward Churchill. He is a University of Colorado professor, much in the news lately, talking about 9/11, why the terrorists pushed back, and blaming, in a sidelong way, the U.S. and the West for genocide. We're going to hear more from Ward Churchill, and we'll have some responses from our guest here in the first half hour of the program, Dr. Gene Edward Veith, as we discuss Ward Churchill and the radical left on college campuses. Now, after our conversation with Dr. Veith and discussing, actually, as culture editor of World Magazine, he has written a story called Hating America. It's a cover story. After we conclude that conversation, Dr. Daniel Gard will be our guest. We're going to be talking to him about Christians and Seder meals. I know what the Passover is. All I got to do is open up the Bible to Exodus chapter 12, and I can read all about the Passover. Where did the Seder come from? Is it the same thing, and should Christians celebrate Passover Seders? We'll deal with that a little later in the program during the second hour. Then Pastor Will Whedon will be our guest in the third hour. We're going to talk about, well, it is St. Patrick's Day, isn't it? We'll talk about the real St. Patrick and hear a bit of what he has written. You may not have been aware of the fact that he wrote a rather long poem about the Trinity. Pastor Will Whedon will share that with us in the third hour of the program. And then to round off that last hour, Wesley Smith will be our guest. Yesterday we talked with Father Johansson about the Nightline program wherein Chris Bury interviewed Michael Schiavo and his attorney, George Filos. Michael Schiavo is the husband and guardian of Terri Schiavo down in Florida, the Florida woman who will have her feeding tube removed tomorrow at 1 o'clock if nothing happens in Washington, D.C. Well, we got the reaction from Father Johansson in the last half hour of the program. We'll get the reaction from Wesley Smith to some of that audio. Our call-in numbers today on Issues Etc., 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Feel free to join our conversation. Dr. Gene Edward Veith is our first guest. He joins us to talk about Ward Churchill and the radical left of college faculties. He is director of the Cranach Institute, a Lutheran voice in the public square, culture editor for World Magazine, and author of the cover story in a recent issue of World titled Hating America. Dr. Veith, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me again.
Well, I know that you are a baseball fan, and before we get into some more serious matters, give us your thoughts on the hearings that began today in Congress on the steroid scandal in National League Baseball.
Well, first of all, I see that as a huge example of government overreaching. That committee is the Government Reform Committee, and it was set up to try to reform different abuses and inefficiencies in government, and it has nothing to do with baseball. And for a congressional committee just to decide that they want to hold hearings and subpoena people, use their power of subpoenas in something that has nothing to do with their authority, to me, it's just completely out of line.
Now, should we hear you as saying that you don't think that illegal steroid use in Major League Baseball is a problem?
No, it is a problem. I think baseball has finally awakened to the problem, and they've put together a pretty good program, I think, to limit that and to punish players and to test players to make sure that they're not using it. And I think when laws are broken, then that should be investigated, and that's a state responsibility. But to me, this particular hearing sounds like a bunch of congressmen that want to sit in front of some famous baseball players and grandstand for it. I don't see that they have any proper jurisdiction to have this hearing. And to me, the government abuse of power, when that happens, is something we really have to take seriously, and that, you know, it's a completely separate question about the players using steroids.
Well, during this conversation, Dr. Veith, we're going to be hearing from someone who faults the government for its overreaching and its abuse of power for an entirely different reason. Ward Churchill, he's a university professor at the University of Colorado. He's been much in the news for some inflammatory statements he has been making about 9/11 and the U.S.'s role in the world. Now, before we hear more from him on that subject and others, is he typical of what you might find in the typical state university classroom?
Well, he really is, and I don't know if he's how representative he is, but I think you'll find people like that on just about every college campus today, people who hold those same views. I was at Ward Churchill's talk at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, and there were a bunch of people picketing and milling around outside, and one of the demonstrators had a sign that said something like, if only the guilty are killed, we would have no more right-wing government. It's pretty inflammatory. So I talked to this guy, and it turns out he's an English professor at the University of Whitewater, a tiny little backwater state university, and an elderly gentleman. And you can find people like that, I think, across the board in the academic world today.
Now, it is one thing to hold a sign that says something like that and to, in the comfort of your own parlor or your own classroom, to talk about, well, you know, we really ought to, this right-wing government really ought to pay the way we're making the terrorists pay for what they do to us. It's another thing to actually advocate terrorism. Here's a bit from Ward Churchill. He was asked a question in another forum about whether or not Americans should rise up against their own government and perform terrorist acts, and if so, how should they do it so, quote, they don't see us coming? Here's Ward Churchill.
Why shouldn't you do something? And how do you move so they don't see you coming? Okay. As to the first part, not a reason in the world that I can see. I can't find a single reason that you shouldn't, in principle way. There may be some practical considerations, such as, do you know how? And the simple answer, although it probably should be more complicated, but I'm not being flippant, given the simple answer, is you carry the weapon. That's how they don't see it coming. You're the one that you're just going to be. They talk about colorblind, they're blind to your color. You said it yourself. Okay? You don't send the Black Liberation Army into Wall Street to conduct an action. You don't send the American Indian Movement into downtown Seattle to conduct an action. Who do you send? You, with your beard shaved, your hair cut close, and wearing a banker's suit.
Now, many have heard Churchill there advocating terrorism. Would you agree?
Well, he is. I mean, he can't get any more clear or any more explicit, and that's a pattern with him. I mean, I think a lot of us have forgotten that Marxism that has been defeated, seemingly, at least in the Soviet Union, so people don't think about it anymore, it argues for violent overthrow of the established order. It advocates, you know, killing of the bourgeois and a forceful takeover of power. And although there aren't many Marxists in Russia anymore or in Eastern Europe anymore, people have freed themselves from that. There are a lot of Marxists and post-Marxists and, you know, new kinds of radicals that still advocate that. That's just ordinary, acceptable rhetoric and tactics for people on the hard left.
Now, Churchill's argument about 9/11 is intriguing. I imagine it's somewhat popular, too. And that is, look, in the U.S.'s action in Iraq and Afghanistan, we have considered non-military targets to be, quote-unquote, collateral damage, and sometimes, if they're being used for military purposes, and if the purposes overlap, legitimate targets. He says that's all the terrorists were doing when they flew those planes into the Twin Towers. They were just considering them collateral damage or an overlap of military and civilian target, therefore a valid target. He says what's good for the goose is good for the gander. How do you respond?
Well, I mean, there's a difference between people that get hurt from a bomb that wasn't aimed at them, and deliberately attacking a center, a civilian center. And, you know, the fact is where Churchill goes far beyond that, it's not just collateral damage. He believes, and he said this and explained it, that the business workers in that in those towers, the financial workers, the accountants, and the executives, and everybody else, is responsible for all of the evil things that he thinks the United States is always doing. Just like Eichmann was, Adolf Eichmann was involved with the Holocaust in Germany, and he never killed anybody, but he made sure the trains ran on time, and he was in charge of the logistical operations that allowed those concentration camps to do their work. And he says that because American capitalism is at the center of all of the world's evils, at the trade center, these were capitalists, and all of this, the bankers and accountants and businessmen, and because they were participants in American capitalism, therefore they are responsible for all of the atrocities that that is supposedly caused in the world. So it wasn't even that, that he said, okay, you know, there are some innocent people that got killed as collateral damage. He says that the people deserve to die and were responsible and a legitimate military target.
Now, much has been made of that little Eichmann's comment, and it has raised the question of academic freedom. Now, much of his comments have been made outside the classroom, but he still is a university professor.
Yeah.
How do we sort out the whole issue of legitimate academic freedom from the kind of statements that Ward Churchill is now routinely making in the press?
Well, from my perspective, he does have academic freedom, and he does have freedom of speech in this country, and I think he does have the right to say those things as horrible as they are. But what bothers me about the academic freedom defense of Ward Churchill is that other people on his own campus who articulate conservative opinions are being silenced and are losing their jobs while Ward Churchill gets tenure and acclaim and the faculty is rallying to defend his academic freedom. I've been studying, writing a follow-up story now, a history professor named Phil Mitchell at the same campus, University of Colorado, who is not going to have his contract renewed simply because he quoted Thomas Sowell and other black critics of affirmative action and threw their ideas out together, why some black people are against affirmative action. And that caused such a furor and such charges of racism and everything, even though he has two black children that he's adopted, that he's going to lose his job. He won Teacher of the Year in 1998 for his program. He's a great teacher. Students love him. He does a great job. He has a doctorate, unlike Ward Churchill. But because he argued, or didn't even argue, because he dared say something that wasn't politically correct, he didn't even say it. He read the words of other people saying it, that's not allowed at the University of Colorado. In other words, academic freedom is designed to protect unpopular positions, but it's not protecting the most unpopular position of all on college campus, namely conservatives and Christians and things that they say. Even at that meeting, this academic freedom, which I believe in, and I support his right to say what he does, although there are other reasons I think he should be removed from his position, but not for saying what he believes. At Whitewater, there's a demonstration for academic freedom of the Democrat, young Democrats had allied with some other groups, and they had a big rally carrying signs about academic freedom. The young Republicans had a candlelight vigil in honor of the 9/11 victims. When the Republicans were having their vigil, the guys carrying academic freedom and free speech signs yelled down the speakers at the candlelight memorial service. During the moment of silence, the guys holding free speech sign were chanting obscenities. During the prayer, they were yelling so loud that you couldn't even hear the prayer. And my problem is not with academic freedom and free speech, both of which I believe in, is that I wish we would have them. And it's the hard left that's not allowing academic freedom or free speech to anybody that holds any kind of conservative or even moderate point of view.
We're talking about Ward Churchill and the radical left on the college campus. Dr. Gene Edward Veith is our guest, culture editor for World Magazine, author of the cover story in a recent issue of World titled Hating America. You can read it on the web at worldmag.com, worldmag.com. Ward Churchill and those like him are fond of talking about the guilt of America. They often couch it in corporate terms. Here's Ward Churchill.
We got this weird thing. Everybody talks about the horror of the process that is America and globalization and military projection and all that. But funny thing about it, nobody seems to be doing it. Anybody on the American side of things gets hurt at all, somehow or another, they were by definition innocent. What do you have to do to actually carry some culpability in this country for what it is that everybody seems to acknowledge this country is doing?
What is he talking about?
Well, he believes that in corporate guilt, that everyone who's an American is guilty for what someone in our government or someone in our military does. And his point about, he talked about Eichmann, but then the little Eichmanns, the little people going around doing our jobs, never hurt anyone, and yet we make this terrible machine possible. And so he sees America purely in terms of all the bad things that have happened and that has gone on in our name. And at his speech, he just went on a catalog of all of the Indians that were killed and all of the colonialism and all of this and all of that and slavery and all of the rest. Of course, it's true. We're in a sinful world, and there have been a lot of sin in this country and everywhere else. But even the good things that this country has done, he dismisses. He says, you know, at least we promote freedom. You know, no, we're not free. The government only makes us think we're free as a way to keep us in line. No, we don't have an overthrown tyrants and dictators. We are the ones that really put them in power. And so he's got this reading of America as this great satanic empire, really, and everyone who's part of this is equally to blame.
And yet, at the same time, I was reading, Dr. Veith, a statement that he issued on the website for the University of Colorado after his Little Eichmann's comment caught so much attention. And he said in that statement, and I paraphrase, but I think this is an accurate paraphrase, that when he said Little Eichmanns, he said, well, I didn't mean the janitors, the food service workers, the maids, the children, the police, and the firefighters. How can he make a distinction if, for instance, the janitors who clean up after the stockbrokers and make sure that their waste baskets are empty in some way are also contributing to that effort? How can he make the distinction?
Well, because they're part of the oppressed masses. Again, he's a Marxist, and his target is the middle class, the property owners, the poor, the workers, the people who do physical labor. He's a champion of them, and he sees them as being oppressed by the evil capitalist system. Now, the irony, he said that at Whitewater, and of course, it was Whitewater is primarily a business school. And it has a very good business program. It turns out lots of accountants and executives and economics people, and that's really their biggest program. And so it's ironic to hear him, because he said the same thing there at Whitewater, that he was, you know, not speaking of the janitors and the file clerks. He was speaking of the, you know, business executives and so on, which ironically is exactly what the students at Whitewater are studying to learn how to be. And they, you know, politely applauded, as if they didn't see that he was talking about them.
We're talking with Dr. Gene Edward Veith. Dr. Veith, would you be willing to stick with us for about 5 minutes on the other side of this break?
Okay.
We have a little bit more audio from Ward Churchill to get Dr. Veith's reaction. And then also, one of the most intriguing things found in his article in World Magazine, Hating America, is the animist worldview, the spiritual aspect to Ward Churchill's thinking. And I wonder if that is unique to Ward Churchill, if that also pervades American academia. If you'd like to join us, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. With just a minute here before we go and a short time to react, here is Ward Churchill again. Here he's talking about how America is essentially globally racist.
Brown-skinned people are supposed to sit out there starving to death in their hundreds of thousands and millions indefinitely until the opposition in this country finds some pill it can take that will allow for a painless solution that preserves its privilege and nobody will get hurt here. But the onus of responsibility of them is to die politely and silently out there out of sight and out of mind while we remain sanitary and painless here. Sorry, that's American exceptionalism of the very worst kind. Very worst kind.
A brief reaction with only a minute here before our break, Dr. Veith?
Well, that's how he sees all of American history, as white people oppressing people with brown skin. He applies that to Indians and blacks and Arabs and everyone all the way through. Of course, the irony is that he claims to be an Indian, but actually it turns out he's white, and yet a lot of his, you know, victimization and his ability to succeed in academia is because he's been posing to be one of these brown-skinned people when he's as white as any of the rest.
Dr. Gene Edward Veith is our guest, director of the Cranach Institute, a Lutheran voice in the public square, culture editor of World Magazine, and author of a cover story in a recent issue of World titled Hating America. He has written a great book called Modern Fascism, and you can get it from Concordia Publishing House, their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. The book is called Modern Fascism by Dr. Gene Edward Veith. Also, look for it on their website, www.cph.org. That's www.cph.org. The book is called Modern Fascism. When we come back, a couple things. Ward Churchill calls for the decolonization of North America. What in the world does he mean by that? He says, in fact, if we were following our own laws, we would decolonize. First to go, Hawaii, Alaska, and then, he says, about two-thirds of the rest of the United States we have no legal claim to. We'll find out how he comes to that conclusion and how he's reading history to come to that conclusion. And with the other side of the break, Dr. Gene Edward Veith will be joining us for just about another 5 minutes, and then we'll be talking about George W. Bush and his recent statements on gay marriage. Stay with us.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
You are one who has lived in rebellion against him. You have treated him as if he wasn't there, as if you had gotten rid of him. Sin ultimately is the attempt to murder God and get rid of him and put yourself in his place. We are unmistakably sinners, and there's no hope for us, except if we're not going to answer for our sins, the only hope is that somebody else would.
In good preaching, the sternness of the law is always answered by the sweetness of the gospel. You'll find the solid preaching of both law and gospel in our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for March, Selected Sermons of Dr. Norman Nagel. The book is $24.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org.
He obeyed God's voice, shared Christ's love, and changed the hearts of many people. This Global Minute gives a glimpse of the missionary life of Patrick as people observe St. Patrick's Day. It's believed Patrick was taken captive when a group of Irish raiders stormed his parents' estate in Britain. During his years in Ireland, he committed his life to God's service, escaped back to Britain, and then later returned to Ireland with the goal of establishing new churches. Today, parties and green beer are associated with St. Patrick's Day. In Dublin, Ireland, the celebration includes a major arts festival along with parades. But let this holiday remind you, Christ may use tough circumstances to deepen our commitment to Him, causing us to share with others about His love. Pray more Christians to commit their lives to Christ's service. Spark your passion for world missions by visiting the website missionvisionnetwork.org. missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Driving to work one day last month, it hit me. It's Valentine's Day, and I'm not wearing red. Another indication I am a social klutz. But today I am wearing green, so happy St. Patrick's Day. When you were in grade school, did you have to memorize Roy G. Biv? Mr. Biv is an acronym for the colors of the prism: red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. Churches that follow the historic liturgy use some of Mr. Biv's colors: red for Pentecost and the outpouring of the Holy Spirit, violet for the season we are now in, Lent, time to think about our sins. White, which is the combination of red, green, and blue, is used for Christmas and Easter, the times of Christ's coming and triumph over death. What's on the altar most of the year, though, is green, not for St. Patrick's Day, but to symbolize that faith in Christ grows and flourishes. Men, ever had my experience? On the way out of the door, your wife says, "You're not going out dressed like that, are you?" Well, go out today in green, not only for St. Patty's Day, but for the faith that comes from mixing the violet of our repentance, the red of God's faith-working Spirit, and the white that is the center of it all, the purity of Jesus Christ.
Here's what's coming up on our Bible study program. On Monday, we continue in the book of Joshua with chapter 22 and Pastor Thomas Eckstein. But next time on the Bible study, it'll be an Ask the Pastor Friday, and our good friend Pastor Joe Cox will be here to answer your questions and take your calls. Ask the Pastor on Friday here on the Bible study. Weekday mornings, 10:05.
The Bible study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Why, by the way, did it take Arabs to do what people here should have done a long time ago?
There again is Ward Churchill, a very brief little audio piece where he's asking, you know, why are the Arabs doing our job for us? We are the ones who should be knocking down the Twin Towers. And that is his worldview. Ward Churchill is typical of what you might find in the radical left on college faculties. And we're talking with Dr. Gene Edward Veith about some of his comments and the general mindset of the radical left. Dr. Gene Edward Veith is culture editor for World Magazine, and he's authored a cover story for a recent edition of World titled Hating America. He's also authored that book, Modern Fascism. Dr. Veith, let's talk about his idea of decolonization. This goes to the whole reading of American history. You said before that he views America from its very inception as a wicked enterprise. Why does he talk about decolonizing North America?
Well, he believes that we took the land basically from the Indians who are already there. We did not follow the treaties that we made with them. He sees that Indians today are sovereign nations, and he believes that our whole nation is based on imperialism and colonialism. Basically, he wants all the land to be given back to the Indians.
So how do you respond? Because it is a matter of history,
yeah,
that the Indians got the short end of the stick than not, and that there were treaties made with, at the time, in a kind of a strange way, interior sovereign nations that were not entirely followed.
Well, that's certainly true. And the history of this country, the history of the whole human race is one of sin and, you know, outrages one after the other. But, you know, what do we do now? He says that we should just obey the laws, that we should just go and see who originally owned the land. And there were some places where the Indians did sign a treaty giving over, you know, portions of land to the white people. And he said, okay, you know, that's fine. But like you said, it would just be about one-third of the size the United States is today. But what do you do when the law is broken? When generations now came who did not break those laws and who did not oppress and cruelly treat people as they had been in the past, what do you do now? And again, he has no mechanism for, you know, wiping the slate clean, for even having a unified nation where people of all races and all backgrounds are all accepted and affirmed in their own right. He has no provision for that. It all has to be conflict of one group violently opposed to the other groups.
And it seems as though if one were to take his advice, there's no place you could really legitimately draw a line. And that is where you could say, yeah, but did this Indian tribe take it from another tribe? Or if we decolonize, where do we go? Well, we're going to go back to land that was once dispossessed from someone else, and the lineage of that dispossession is as long as human history.
Yeah.
Pretty soon you end up with perhaps the absurd conclusion that human beings have no right to occupy any space on this planet.
Well, that's right. That's about what it comes down to. Because you're right. Even in Europe, there were, you know, England belonged to the Celts, and then the Romans took it, and then the Saxons moved in, and then some of the French, the Norman conquest moved in, and the Danes, and it's all of history for every spot of land on the earth is going to be sort of that way, and you can never find, you know, the primeval ancestor that can claim title, and if you did, no one would have any place to live.
Finally, you bring out something in your World Magazine article about the spiritual aspect of Ward Churchill's thinking. You call it his animist worldview. Explain, please.
Yeah, well, he said that the way he looks at the attacks on the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, he said it wasn't just the Arab terrorists with their box cutters that took over those planes. He saw it in terms of the spirits of the ancestors. And he said that on that plane were the spirits of the ancestors of all the children that were killed by the sanctions against Iraq, all of the slaves that had been so mistreated in American history, all of the American Indians who were massacred, and on and on and on. And so that it was the spirits of these people from the past that were really on that airplane guiding them into the World Trade Center. Now, I don't know if he meant that as a metaphor. He tied it to the thinking of his people, as he called it, in that a lot of the American Indian tribes, when they're not Christian, you know, they have an animistic kind of religion that believes in spirits of various kinds, and he was sort of invoking that. And it turned into a sort of a karma sort of thing that, you know, what you do in the past, you pay for in the future, sort of like Hinduism. Although when somebody asked him about that, he said, no, he doesn't want to think of it in Hinduism terms, he wants to think of it in terms of his people, in other words, the Native American animist kind of deal. And I think that the left is, that may be one difference with the old communism, which is based on dialectical materialism and, you know, economics, they reduce everything to economics. The new hardcore left does seem to have a way of sort of spiritualizing issues, which is one way they really demonize the enemy, make the enemy, namely ordinary Americans, into demons worthy of being killed, and they see their own cause as having this sort of spiritual sanction that will eventually win out over the forces of darkness. So it's as if there's sort of the left is becoming kind of spiritualized, at least in their thinking, which constitutes yet another sort of dangerous kind of political religion.
Dr. Gene Edward Veith, thank you very much for being our guest.
My pleasure.
Dr. Gene Edward Veith is director of the Cranach Institute, a Lutheran voice in the public square. You can check out their website by going first to oursissuesetc.org. Click on links, and you'll find a direct link to Dr. Gene Edward Veith and the Cranach Institute. Did you happen to see the story on Good Morning America? It dealt with the reaction of Roman Catholic leaders to Dan Brown's best-selling book, The Da Vinci Code. A movie's coming out. It's going to involve two luminaries from Hollywood. And the story dealt with these Roman Catholics finally kind of marshaling a unified response to the Da Vinci Code. Here's the report from Good Morning America.
Talk about a bad review. Later today, Italian Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone, a man who is a potential successor to the Pope, will speak out publicly, arguing the best-selling book The Da Vinci Code is a shameful perversion of the story of the Holy Grail and a pack of lies attempting to discredit Catholicism. Bertone says he's upset that so many readers believe the plotline that Jesus and Mary Magdalene had a child whose heirs continue today, and that a male-dominated church has for centuries conspired to hide this fact and its feminine side. Father Richard McBrien, a theology professor at Notre Dame, says no one should take the book as gospel.
It's a novel. It's a work of fiction. It's not a work of history.
But Bertone and others worry the book is being taken seriously. And after all, it's more than widely read.
With more than 29 million copies in print, it is the best-selling adult hardcover fiction book of all time.
And its author does not argue it's just a good yarn.
The moment that I started to understand that Jesus could have been married and could have had a child, and that I personally was okay with that, that was a revelation.
A revelation coming soon to a theater near you. In a few weeks, director Ron Howard reunites with Tom Hanks to begin filming the Da Vinci Code movie.
Though Father McBrien, a consultant to the film, says that might be less controversial.
There are going to be some things in there that may have been regarded as gratuitously offensive to Catholics or to others that will be muted or taken out.
They might want to reconsider that. Religious movies that offend people have not done so bad lately. For Good Morning America, Jake Tapper, ABC News, Washington.
Okay, now that's the story from ABC News, Good Morning America. The Vatican marshaling a response to the Da Vinci Code. Dan Brown's book, we've talked about it many times here on the program, is intriguing? Yes, certainly it is. Now, to follow up on this, here's some more Roman Catholic response to the Da Vinci Code. This is Vatican analyst John Allen. He says that the Vatican simply couldn't be silent on the Da Vinci Code anymore.
I think there's a sense among senior church officials that you simply can't ignore something like this, that lots of people are carrying this book around. You know, lots of people are walking through this town and others on Da Vinci Code tours, and many of them undoubtedly are taking it seriously.
Now, he's talking about people actually coming to Rome, to the Vatican, and taking Da Vinci Code tours. Have you heard about this? They go to these places not for any genuine historical interest, but to see how it fits into a fictional novel. Now, by the way, if you were listening to that ABC News Good Morning America report, Dan Brown doesn't believe it's fictional. In fact, we played audio from Dan Brown before where he says, look, I think it's all true. The only fictional thing in my book are the characters. The rest of it's history. He's convinced even himself, or at least he says he's convinced even himself, and many others are convinced. Think about that. Let's go on a vacation, honey, and take a Da Vinci Code tour. So you go see the Last Supper, and you go looking for Mary Magdalene rather than the Apostle John next to Jesus. And you go to the various places named in the book and in and around Rome and Vatican City. And you say, ah, there we go. There's some more evidence that Dan Brown told us about in his book. So why is it so popular? Father Greg Parcell, he's rector of Santa Susanna, the American Catholic Church in Rome. He explains the popularity of Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code.
People also love conspiracy theories. People also love stories that are in many ways against an institution, and what bigger institution is other than the Catholic Church.
I couldn't agree more. You can make a million and sell a million overnight by simply tapping into those two sensibilities. And I think it is largely the sensibility of the baby boom generation. Not exclusively, but largely the sensibilities of the baby boom generation. They love conspiracy theories. And they love to be anti-institutional. The bigger the institution, the more authority vested in the institution, the more they love suspecting it. And the two, it's amazing. You wonder, why have all these conspiracy... I mean, they've always been with us, but why have all these conspiracy theories suddenly grown like mushrooms in the backyard of American culture recently? Well, I think it can be linked to a large degree to the mindset of the baby boom generation. Maybe they're just bored because they were raised with too much, or maybe they were too well educated, or maybe it's how they were educated in leftist universities. I don't know. We've got 15 minutes of open lines. I'd like your reaction to some of this audio that we're playing and to Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. Finally, the Vatican, at least in the form of one cardinal, is ready to speak out, even as the movie is ready to go into production. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, if you noticed at the end of the Good Morning America report, one of the priests that was a consultant to the film said, now, there are going to be some offensive things in the book that won't make it into the movie. It's going to be sanitized a little bit. Now, if you're a Da Vinci Code fan, does that upset you that the movie won't be as controversial as the book? What if they take out one of your favorite aspects of the conspiracy theory? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Here again is Father Parcell. He says that the book, The Da Vinci Code, can be used to educate people, however.
They're reading it, so they've got some sense of what the issues are. So why not use it as a way of saying, okay, these are in here, but let's talk about the truth of these facts.
Can you educate them? That's the thing. Someone who's going to be going to Vatican City or Rome on a Da Vinci Code tour, do they want to be educated on the true history? Because after all, the true history is kind of boring. And if they are willing to suspect even the church's teaching about Jesus not being married to Mary Magdalene, not having children whose descendants are with us here today, if they're willing to buy Dan Brown's version of Christianity, which is more exciting, more cloak and dagger than the true story, are they really going to want to be educated? To a people who have already addicted, see, that's the danger of the conspiracy theory. The danger of the conspiracy theory is not only that it misinforms and misdirects and wastes people's time, but the conspiracy theory, whatever it may be, is addictive. To those who get into it, they become addicted. Not to any particular conspiracy theory. No, do you know someone who's a conspiracy buff? Everybody knows one. Everybody knows one guy that when you get into a conversation with them, about 5 minutes in, they're ready to tell you about how the government is doing this or the government's doing that. And you may not know this, but I read it in a book, and there it is on the internet, and shortwave radio told me about it too. And pretty soon, they've got an entire worldview constructed for you. They don't stick with one theory for very long, do they? Why? Because these things are addictive. And when one starts to fall apart or the headlines don't support it, they move on to another. They get a sense of comfort from it. It's a little bit like being a drug addict. And even sensible Christians who otherwise are concerned for the truth sometimes entertain in part or in whole some of these conspiracy theories. Oh, but when it shows up in Dan Brown's book, that conspiracy theory is bad. The church is doing this. The church is doing that. And it doesn't have to be the Roman church, by the way. Now, one group that gets a lot of ink in the Da Vinci Code is a conservative Catholic group called Opus Dei. Andrew Sloan, spokesperson for Opus Dei, says that this book doesn't give an accurate account of their organization in any way whatsoever. Here he is.
The Da Vinci Code gives the impression that we are conspirators in a worldwide conspiracy, and that we dress in monkish robes and that we assassinate people. Not that I've got anything but the harsh respect for monks, but we're not that way.
The funniest thing is, and this is purely personal, usually when I preach someplace, I dress in a black cassock and a white cincture and a big, big crucifix. People who've seen me preach can see me coming. They spot the crucifix before anything else, which I didn't know, but it just so happens to be kind of the way these Opus Dei guys dress. I preached one place once where someone who probably should have known better said, I was wondering whether you, what kind of statement you were trying to make by dressing like the Opus Dei priests. I'm like, well, look, I wear black because my robes, it doesn't show the dirt. I wear the crucifix for an obvious reason. And the belt kind of holds it all together, and I don't own a black one. Oh, yeah. Well, if I were a member of Opus Dei, I couldn't tell you because it's a secret organization, right? Maybe I'm secretly promulgating Opus Dei doctrines throughout the Lutheran Church. Now, there's a conspiracy theory. You know, there's some of our listeners who believe I am just that powerful. I have the ability to cloud men's minds. No, powerful and dangerous, too. Maybe I should come to work dressed that way. You know, we've got these publicity shots here, and I'm wearing a tie. I think it'd be more effective if I had me in the black cassock, the big crucifix, and the white cincture. I even have the power to cost presidents elections. Although, I didn't do it this last time, even though I wasn't trying. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, speaking of presidents, President George W. Bush held a press conference yesterday. First, a general impression, then we'll get to the audio. I was listening to this press conference. How can you not like this guy? He's just a nice fellow. Yeah, he's a little folksy and his grammar's off, but I'm listening to him, and I'm tempted at this point to fall into, when I'm listening to this thing, fellow Texan, I like him, to stop listening to what he's actually saying and just say, I just love George W. Bush. I'm tempted to do that, so I'm driving home from a chapel yesterday, listening live to the press conference. And I'm making every effort, because I really do sincerely like George W. Bush, to hear what he's saying. Now, what did he say when he was asked, well, here's the question and the answer, on the issue of gay marriage from yesterday's press conference?
President Bush, a court ruling in California this week has revived debate over same-sex marriage. You support a constitutional amendment to ban such marriages, but it's not something you talk about nearly as often as Social Security and many other issues. Mm. Will you put some muscle behind that effort this year, or is it something you'd prefer not to deal with?
No, I haven't changed my position, and as a matter of fact, the court rulings are verifying why I took the position I took. And that is, I don't believe judges ought to be deciding this issue. I believe this is an issue of particular importance to the American people and should be decided by the people. And I think the best way to do so is through the constitutional process. I haven't changed my mind at all. As a matter of fact, court rulings such as this strengthen my position, it seems like to me. People now understand why I laid out the position I did.
What can you do to promote action on that amendment?
Well, the courts are going to promote a lot of the action by their very rulings. People will understand that the logic behind the decision I made. And no matter what your position is on the issue, this is an issue that should be decided by the people, not by judges. And the more the judges start deciding the issue, I'm confident the more the people will want to be involved in the issue. This is a very important issue for the country, and one that obviously needs to be conducted with a great deal of sensitivity and concern about other people's feelings. But this is an issue I feel strongly about.
All right, now, I was listening to this, and two things struck me. In fact, one thing struck me twice. He didn't answer the question. The reporter asked, what are you gonna do? Are you going to put muscle behind your support for traditional marriage? Are you going to put muscle behind it? Now, in terms of a president, this means, are you going to do what presidents do when they're behind something? Are you going to go twist arms, shake hands, pat backs, do all the things that presidents do, take your case to the American people in detail on the issue of gay marriage? That was the question. What are you going to do? His answer was, I haven't changed my position. Now, she didn't ask whether or not his position had changed. She asked, what are you going to do? Obviously, you are against gay marriage and for traditional marriage. What are you going to do? Well, my position hasn't changed. And nowhere in the first answer did he actually say what he's going to do. Now, I raised this question before the election, I'm sure. And that is, what is to stop President George W. Bush on this crucial moral and social issue of gay marriage from getting in, jumping in, and doing something? What's to stop him? It's one thing to say, I support a constitutional amendment if it actually comes about, and it's one thing to frame the whole situation as judicial activism. Those are both great things to do. And I agree with him about three quarters on gay marriage, because he believes there should be no gay marriage, but he doesn't have a real problem in principle with civil unions. That's the one quarter I disagree with him. Civil unions, to my way of thinking, are gay marriage by another name. And maybe he'll come around on that. I don't know. But once, not once, but twice, he did not answer the question. Now, the reporter backed up and tried it again. What action are you going to take? And he said, well, this is going to be up to the people, not judges. What about the people, the man in the White House? Do you want to see George W. Bush do something about gay marriage? All right. Just something to pay attention to. As much as I like the guy, it is, you got to pay attention to what they say and their actual words. When we come back, we're going to talk about Christian Seder meals. I know what the Passover is. Exodus 12. I'm less sure on what a Seder is, and I'm wondering whether Christians ought to celebrate the Passover Seders. Dr. Daniel Gard will join us to talk about that in the second hour of the program. In the third hour, two guests. First, Pastor Will Whedon on the St. Patrick's Day. We'll talk about the real 5th century bishop and missionary, St. Patrick, and hear a little bit of what he had written. And then, in the last half hour of the program, Wesley Smith will join us. He will react to Nightline Tuesday night, where Michael Schiavo and his attorney had a few things to say. I'm sure Wesley will have a few things to say in the last 25 minutes of that program. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Hour 2.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.